Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Can you hear me on the phone?
I've got you coming out of every orifice.
I'm really not, you're breaking up quite badly.
Hello and welcome to The Lock-In, where I finally get to talk to people I want to hear from in a place I want to be, the pub.
For some reason, this bloody thing has started playing back some rubbish.
Oh, right.
Where were we? I forgot.
I have too.
Now, pay attention at the back. Today I'm talking to one of the smartest men in Britain. Sir David Omond is a spy, or he was. He ran the National Eavesdropping Centre, GCHQ. He was the first security and intelligence coordinator in Britain, which in layman's terms is the country's top spy. And now he's produced a book called How Spies Think. Sir David, what do you think makes a good spy?
If you're talking about an intelligence officer, then my answer would be it has to be somebody who is prepared to accept the life of an intelligence officer, not to seek personal fame or celebrity, but who is content to work in the service of the country quietly behind the scenes. That, I think, is the first requirement, because walking into five-star hotels and saying the name's Bond, James Bond, is not the kind of behaviour that suits an effective intelligence officer.
But do you think you could make a spy out of anyone?
Yes, and if you look at, say, the British intelligence community, you've got an enormously diverse range of people who are working in the intelligence business, from, you know, the pure mathematicians at GCHQ through to the...
Your book is full of things that most of us don't understand, like Bayesian reasoning, for example. Do you have to be clever to be a spy?
It helps. It helps because the intelligence analyst, and my book is really about intelligence analysts, the analyst has to put the jigsaw puzzle together without the picture on the lid of the box, and knowing that somebody has muddled up a number of jigsaw puzzle pieces all together. So you do have to have an analytic ability. Of course, if you're chosen profession takes you into human recruitment of human agents, then that's rather different. And there, of course, you would look for empathy.
I've come across a few spies over the years. They're always quiet, unassuming, the absolute opposite of James Bond.
Yes, you want the person who, when they walk into a room, nobody notices they've come into the room, rather than the person who one can think of most modern politicians who would expect the room to go slightly quiet and people to notice they'd made an entrance. That is the last thing you would want.
You ended up being one of the country's top intelligence officers. What was your plan B for your life?
Originally, when I graduated, it was academia. it was doing a doctorate, and I indeed had a grant and a place to do a doctorate in a rather obscure part of mathematical economics, but gave up the idea and thought, well, I think I'd better get a job. I wanted to work in the public sector. I didn't want to join the private sector. This was 1969, after all. And GCHQ seemed a very interesting place to join.
I've been there, and it is absolutely fascinating. Always struck me as being rather like a university.
It is in some ways, except that the big difference, as I discover at the moment, my second career is in academia. You're accumulating knowledge and understanding of the world as an academic, but in the intelligence world, you're doing it for a purpose. You're trying to improve the decisions that your government or your military forces have to make. So it's very directed in that sense, whereas most academic work it's more the pursuit of knowledge for its own sake.
One of the things that struck me was how relaxed it was, how many young people were there.
You would find that right across the British intelligence community, and in part it's a post 9/11 phenomenon, because at the end of the Cold War, there was either a pause in recruitment or in some rundown when the Soviet Union ceased to exist. And then, of course, the shock of 9/11, the danger of from terrorism, led to rapid increases. The security service probably doubled in size. And so when you walk around now, you see younger faces. The other thing that happened at the same time was the advent of the internet and the rise of digital intelligence. And that's a natural playground for younger minds.
You've already put your finger on one of the things that's distinctive about intelligence work, and that is that you don't disclose to anyone what you do. How big a burden is that psychologically?
I think it suits certain personality types. If you really found it a burden, you probably wouldn't stay. You'd find something else to do. So it does rather suit the quiet types rather than the extroverts. The meaning of secrecy in that world has rather been redefined in the last decade or so, because what is really, really secret and must always remain secret despite the interests of journalists and others, is which techniques are being applied to which targets to try and prize out their secrets. But the existence of the techniques themselves is not a secret. There was a bit of a fuss when the material from Edward Snowden was publicized, because people hadn't realized just how powerful these digital intelligence techniques were. But there are now university departments, you know, publishing papers on these subjects. So cryptography and recruitment of human agents, these are as ancient as history itself. So the techniques are known about and indeed quite widely researched from an academic point of view, but which ones have been picked by an intelligence officer to try and get at the secrets of a particular target, a terrorist, a narcotics gang, people smugglers, autocrats and dictators, you name them. That has to remain a secret because it's so easy for the target otherwise to dodge.
What do you think is the best television depiction of your world, the espionage world, that you've seen?
I have the Alec Guinness series of from the Le Carre books were very good, partly because he's such a brilliant actor, but partly because of that sense of the intellectual side, the trying to piece together the jigsaw puzzle, who is the traitor in the ranks.
You've never been tempted to write a spy novel, have you?
No, I'm not sure I could manage the sex scenes. It's a hazard, I think, for any would-be novelist, is the Bad Sex Award.
Can you summarise what your book's about, then? Who's it intended for?
Well, it's intended for anyone who is interested in thinking more clearly. And it's really, it's my personal call to arms in favour of rational analysis to support decision-making. And it doesn't really matter whether that's for government, whether it's for business, or indeed it's for any of us when we have a big decision to take, like whether to move house or seek another job or indeed seek a life partner.
How would a spy think about the question of moving house?
I think the analyst would know that when you have a big decision to take, there are two separate kinds of thinking that you have to hold together in your mind at the same time. There's the cold, rational analysis. How much can you afford to spend? What do you want out of the area that you're going to move to? How far away is the GP or the, if you've got children, the local schools? All the sort of factual stuff that you've got to analyse really rather carefully. And then you've got the passionate side. What was motivating you to want to get out of the city and into the deepest countryside or vice versa? Or what was it you were afraid of?
Well, that just sounds like common sense.
Well, it is common sense. But then if it is common sense, why are so many decisions made on the basis of inadequate analysis? Why do governments promise us things that they can't deliver? It may be common sense when you set it down, as I've tried to do in a book, in stages, my four kinds of output you get from analysis, you know, knowing what's going on, explaining what's going on, beginning to estimate how things might unfold if you take your decision, and then making sure you don't get socked on the back of the head by something you hadn't seen coming. That's a very basic way of thinking about analysis of any situation. But it's quite hard work. It's harder work than most people want to put in. And the emotional side, this is the other message in my book, is that because of the advent of social media in particular, the emotional side of decision making has tended to swamp the analysis. And so much of what you obtain from going online, it's falsehoods, it's deceptions, it's half-truths, and it's some deliberate material aimed at widening divisions in society and setting us at each other's throats. And we saw that in the 2016 US presidential election very clearly. It's the dark underside of that wonderful invention, the internet, on which, you know, we're so completely dependent.
You say the internet is still wonderful, but one of the characteristics of it is this proliferation of social media in which people say anything, doesn't matter whether it's true or not, and it can be as poisonous as you like.
Well, that's the dark side. The upside is, how would we have survived the COVID experience and keeping in touch with loved ones? How would we have managed work? I give my lectures, university lectures now online. How would we have kept things going during the first stage of the pandemic without having these social media apps? But Jimmy Wales, the creator of Wikipedia, had a rather nice way of putting it, which is that social media is driven by the advertisements. And the incentive is to show you as many ads as possible. So the time you spend on a site and clicks per minute and so on is what matters. And that creates addictive products. And so the social media prioritize agitation and argumentation in a negative sense over education and learning and thoughtfulness. Now, there's obvious risk of being naive here, because we've always had in political debate a bit of political swagger and exaggeration of the benefits of a policy. And personal ambitions and rivalries are inseparable from democratic politics. but we shouldn't have to suffer people who blur or even deny the very nature of truth. There is no such thing as alternative facts.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There are alternative approaches, of course. I was very interested in the stuff in your book about contrarian narratives, and particularly this group of people in Israel who are employed to think the opposite of received wisdom and report directly to the Prime Minister.
Yes, indeed. And this was after Israel was almost caught by a complete surprise in 1973 when attacked by Egypt and Syria. And at the very last minute, news of the impending attack came from their top agent in Egypt, who in fact was Nasser's son-in-law. Extraordinary story. But having almost been caught out, they decided that enough was enough and that they would have this group of expert analysts whose job it was to sort of challenge prevailing orthodoxy. It's quite an expensive thing to do because you're taking some of your very best people, and most of the time they're challenging unnecessarily, so they become rather unpopular. We've tried that in the UK in a small way by having some of the analysts in the Cabinet Office who support the Joint Intelligence Committee deliberately tasked with a devil's advocate, well, go back and really re-examine this material, which they didn't write, but a group of analysts coming in. And, you know, that can be quite useful. One might have wished we'd done that in 2002 in the run-up to the Iraq War. It probably wouldn't have made any difference because the underlying intelligence, was flawed. But who knows, it might have done.
It might have helped during lockdown. It would have given a lot of scientists who were sceptical about lockdown the chance to dissent and to be taken seriously.
Well, in a sense, that already existed because I don't detect there was groupthink inside the SAGE and its various subgroups. There probably was some rather vicious and pointed arguments about it, but that would deal with the science. So I think we can trust the scientists. I certainly do. The ones that are on these committees who are not in the pay of government. I mean, I trust them to argue from rationally. Where you get the difficulties is when people then grab a slogan. The sort of the COVID deniers or lockdown deniers, and without really having the soundly based explanations, sort of push that. That I think that's just another aspect of what I complain about in the book.
Are people getting more credulous?
I don't have the evidence to come to that conclusion. Anecdotally, I certainly come across cases where I am really very surprised that people believe or say they believe what they appear to believe. I think some of the anti-vaxxer material is so bonkers that you wonder how could anybody actually come to believe that. But then we've probably always had a few rather obsessive people. There's a chapter in my book on obsessionals, and it can affect, you know, perfectly intelligent people who just become obsessed about one thing. They're quite difficult to shift from their beliefs.
You seem to suggest that in all our schools there ought to be a programme to strengthen the roots of liberal democracy. How would it work?
Well, take my book, turn it into a suitable form for a younger audience, and off you go. But it is about two things. One is about how to stay safe online. Not only safe from paedophiles, but safe from really bad, dangerous ideas. And by teaching people how to analyze the material that's coming in. That seems to me rather important. And it's about to understand how social media actually works.
But who determines what's a dangerous idea?
Well, in the end, it's a societal decision. We are a democracy. These things do get debated in Parliament. At the moment, we've got some very dangerous anti-vax propaganda out there. There are websites which are dedicated to trying to show that the vaccines that are being developed are dangerous. Now, there is not a shred of scientific evidence in favour of that proposition, and there's a great deal of scientific evidence in favour of the contrary. In other words, that the tests that have been done rigorously and evaluated rigorously. Yet these sites are there. Now, it's a public health problem if too many people access those sites and begin to believe that, because the whole point of vaccination is to build up resistance in the population, so that our lockdowns and mask wearings and all the rest of it become a thing of the past. So that's a dangerous idea and example. But by teaching critical thinking directly, you can relate it to the world that the upcoming generation are going to inhabit, which is one in which they've never known anything but social media. They haven't known an era before social media and the internet.
You say that all material on the internet ought to carry the name and address of its originator. They just make it up, wouldn't they?
Yes, but if they, certainly you can try and get around that. But then you've, in a sense, when you found it, you've got them. One of the problems that the United States ran into with the 2016 US presidential election was material being fed in from the Russian intelligence services purporting to come from US citizens. That is clearly, in fact, in US term, that's unlawful. Now, if once you've pinned them to the lie, you can then expose them and, if necessary, try and sanction them. So I think there is something to be said for that principle, that if you're putting political material out, you should say who funded it, or at least give the identity of the organisation, the front organisation, if you like, that's funding it.
What do you think we ought to do with Edward Snowden? If he were one of ours, for example, what do you think should happen to him?
I think it's probably too late, as it were, to do, in inverted commas, anything with him. He's in Moscow. He's made himself a new life. I can't help feeling that if he got into the hands of reputable journalists at the very beginning, and he'd agreed to be flanked by the editor of The Guardian and the editor of the New York Times or the Washington Post. And they'd appeared in public, in front of the cameras, in front of the Senate Oversight Committee, and to tell them, I don't think the administration has told you the full story. Here are half a dozen documents that demonstrate that they, in that case, the warrantless intercept program was going on, and the committee probably was not fully informed about it. There would have been a political storm. The administration would have been obliged to do what the Obama administration actually did, which is rein in the program. They issue new directions. Snowden would have been a hero. Instead, he fills, you know, his USB sticks with all the material he can get his hands on, including top secret material from DCHQ, and flees the country, including material on, for example, intelligence to support current military operations. And some of the media outlets then publish that kind of material, which is deeply, deeply damaging. So he overreacted. He didn't follow the kind of UN, United Nations guidance for whistleblowers.
It was right, though, wasn't it, that the public learned about the extent of surveillance?
Up to a point, yes, I agree with that. And we've now got a new law, the 2016 Investigatory Powers Act in the United Kingdom, that puts it all under the rule of law, regulates it, adds judges who have to countersign warrants and all of that. My point would be, why on earth didn't they organize all that before the leaks? So the leaks would not have been necessary.
Was there anyone telling them to?
I suspect so, but it was probably never the right moment for a minister to put their head above the parapet on such. But the irony is, of course, the net result of the Snowden material being publicised is that there's more of that kind of intelligence gathering going on than there was before, because almost every country on the planet, whilst complaining about the United States surveillance, turned to their intelligence officers and said, well, why can't we have some of that? And, you know, a little industry has grown up making the equipment to allow some of this to take place.
Sir David, thank you very much.
Lovely to talk to you.
There you are, Sir David Omand, a quiet type. Next week, we've got the host of the Talking Politics podcast, David Runciman, who's going to talk to me about politics, of course, specifically the future of democracy, if there is one. Please join me for that, and in the meantime, do stay safe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford Tough, Built Ford Proud.